Welcome to another episode of Cushman & Wakefield's Bottom Line, Decoding Growth. I'm delighted to have with us Mike Holland, someone I've had the privilege of knowing and working for over three decades. I'm particularly delighted to have him joining me here today from our Singapore office. Michael Holland, or Mike as he's fondly known, is one of the region's most experienced institutional real estate leaders. With over three decades across Asia and Europe, he played a foundational role in building the International Property Consultant, or IPC, business in India, went on to lead major office platforms, and later spearheaded the creation of India's first listed REIT at Embassy Office Parks. Today, he continues to shape thinking on capital, governance, and the future of work through his roles at AGP Sustainable Real Assets and across India's listed real asset ecosystem. Mike, a very warm welcome. So Mike, I'll start off with the interesting anecdote as to how we met, and I'm sure you got your part of that story as well. I remember in 1997, I got a call from you. I was in Indonesia, which was in the middle of a meltdown because of the Southeast Asian tiger crisis at that point in time. I was working with an affiliate of Jones Lang Lutton, JLW at that stage, now JLL, in Indonesia, and you called and you said, I'm from Ireland, I'm working in Singapore, but I'm heading to India to start the office of JLW, now JLL, and would I like to join you? So that was a very surprise call, but really, I mean, what prompted you, and maybe an anecdote from your side first?
Yeah, I mean, I think what that underscores is a couple of things. The long-term relationships in our industry, particularly in Asia, that both you and I, we've built fantastic friendships through business over 30 years, I was thinking as I was coming over this morning. And another takeaway is that 30 years ago, it was a very isolated world. So when I was asked to do the business plan for the India business, I'd never been to India before. I think I can almost with certainty say I'd never worked with any Indians before. There were no Indians in our office here in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And you think about what's happened over the last three decades about how India and its wonderful people have come to be part of the global economy. And the reason that I picked up the phone to you was I said to the senior partners here, I'll happily go to India, but there must be somebody in our whole organization worldwide, there must be an Indian guy who can help hold my hand as I go in and introduce me to a few people. So that's how I came to call you, and I often think very fondly about that, and you of course introduced me to my current business partner, Rajpal Chowdhury, who's had a massive impact on all of our lives.
Yeah, remind me to take a broker's commission on that introduction. I never got that.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. You know, so those two things, the business friendships that we've all made through our careers in Asia and in particular in India, but also how the world's completely transformed. And India now, today, is you know, the largest population in the world. It's jumped up the GDP rankings every few years. It's definitely a force to be reckoned with. And in your business, I'm sure that's also the case. So, yeah, it was a good, it was a great introduction and set of introductions that you made for me. Thank you.
You know, apart from the lovely company you had at that point in time in me and Avnish, and I'm sure that was a draw coming into India, but probably not enough. You were sort of a young project management professional back then here in Singapore. You know, you sort of previous to that, you'd worked in the UK. What really prompted you to, and India was not exactly on fire at that point.
Yep.
You know, we are talking late 90s here. What really prompted you to, you know, to just jump on this opportunity and go to India?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the beauties of being at the early stage in one's career is that if interesting opportunities are put in front of you, you've got fewer commitments and less baggage than you might have as you get older and a little bit more staid. So I had the good fortune to have the choice, really, to go to New York, to stay in Singapore, to go back to London, or to go to a new country and a new business in India. And I, you know, I like new businesses. I like gestating those. I over the years have come to really know and love Asia. I like the energy in Asia. I sometimes say Asia for business, Europe for leisure. And in those days, it was uncharted water, and that's exciting for me. And of course, in life and in your career, you need to take considered risks. And so it was a considered risk. I think it was a life-changing move for me.
So in many ways, you were one of the founding CEOs, founding leaders for the IPC industry in India, right? And the industry was very nascent. What were the trials and tribulations you went through very early in the industry as the CEO of, you know, a IPC in India?
I think with maturity, I would count all of those companies and all of those names as really good, solid, strong business friends. I think with immaturity, both of the market and maybe of the individuals, it was quite competitive in those days. There was definitely not as anywhere close to the volume of business until it started to take off in the early 2000s, and that was occupier driven. So I think the challenges were, it was still very much a early stage developing market. We took a very clear decision to hire and kind of grow our own timber. So to hire bright young people and mold those people and have that group mold each other. So there was a lot of hard work, but very fulfilling to work with such a super bunch of enthusiastic, hardworking, relatively inexperienced, but absolutely open to learning and keen to learn. So those were the compensations for the fact that it was a small market, it was tough to make money, it was a loss-making business, it was an investment by the franchise to build those platforms. And I think any one of the platforms that you mentioned today would be talking about thousands of people in India. And I'd imagine that for many of them, India might well be their largest single entity, whether in APAC, including China, Japan, I'm not sure, but it would be one of the largest businesses for every one of those franchises.
So. And so it is, yeah. For sure. I think India now is in top five countries in the world for most, right. Most of the big IPCs. So, and it's kind of great to see how the markets kind of evolved. Now, in those sort of, you know, early years, 5 or 6 years, was there ever a feeling this is a mistake?
So the answer to that, no. I think part of that is the focus and energy, largely a bunch of young guys working really intensely and learning from each other. You know, when you're a strong team, there really isn't room to say, is this a mistake? You've got to be steadfast in what's your objective. And I used to get up every morning with my small little old Nokia phone, and when I turned it on, it would flash up a signal that said number one in 2000. And that was an objective that I set for myself when we were going into the market. I don't think that we achieved that. We certainly became a leading player within a couple of years of that. But you can't allow it, or if you get to a stage in any venture that you say, is this a mistake, then that will distract you from the driving focus. So it was tough, but enjoyable. Like a great game of tennis or rugby, you know, a sport game, it's not meant to be easy. You're meant to stretch yourself and through that rigor, get stronger and get better.
Yep, quite well said, actually. And you know, and you kind of tried a number of things after that, all very successful. But what I'll probably want to focus a bit on is an entrepreneurial journey, part one, I suppose. When you joined with some of your ex-JLL colleagues, Rajpal, you mentioned, and of course Ben, and created this development management company called Assets, which is now a full-fledged development company, and went into Sarjapur Outer Ring Road, the hub of sort of IT tech in Bangalore, and created a magnificent campus. And this was happening while GFC was happening in the background, 2008-09, right? So how was that journey? I mean, that's probably got to be one of the tougher times to go through in your career.
Yeah, it was a challenge, but I don't know whether it's India, but or many markets, it was a long-term play. That particular asset that you referred to, which we developed as a 112-acre SEZ, Special Economic Zone. But the story on that asset, which I started working on with Rajpal and Ben back in 2006-07, the story actually goes back at 5 years prior, when Rajpal was doing a town planning consultancy for Bangalore. And one of the elements on the town plan was a new ring road. So there was a ring road to be built. And that, of course, with his smart entrepreneurial mindset, he went about figuring out how we could get an option on over 100 acres of land where a ring road was about to be built. And that was the start. So it's not that it started at the time of GFC. We developed that, and we were really working as a development manager for a fee, reinvesting capital. And then, yeah, there were some tough years, not just with GFC, but you'll remember the whole Satyam scandal that was at least as impactful to the real estate industry in India for a short term, anyway, for a year, as the GFC. So it was tough. Again, it was hard work, but it's been rewarding in multiple different ways. I think the industry in that early to mid 2000s went from a nascent emerging market, and there were three factors simultaneously over the first 5-6 years. You had occupier demand starting to emerge as the world of Friedman, the world is flat, started to come in, and you had international corporates coming into India. So there was an occupier drive that was getting faster and faster, that needed new office facilities because there was nothing that was suitable. You had this new SEZ Act in, I think, 2005, which allowed some tax benefits around large-scale sites, and you had FDI into real estate. Those three components came together in a crescendo, and the market got hotter and hotter and hotter. And of course, you know, we've seen that all over the world. Real estate cycles, they'll often come with a crashing halt, and that happened around about 2008-09. Those were tough years. India's high interest rate environment and a lot of real estate development was significantly levered. So then there was a very painful period for 4 or 5 or 6 years. There were a few political things going on in some places like Hyderabad. And that was when I think the smart institutional money, and you know, in my view, you know, I've got a very close and privileged to have a relationship with Blackstone. They had sat on the sidelines from when they entered in 2007 and made their first real estate investment in around about 2011. And of course, that would have been taking advantage of some of the dislocation that had happened and the corrections that were happening, maybe the over-leverage that had happened, and set themselves up for great success in the following decade. So it's a long cycle and a long journey, and just like everyone else, we went through some really good times and some tough times, and you have to keep going.
Correct. So you talk about three pivotal moments, right? And I think very rightly and aptly put. Was there an aha moment for sort of Indian real estate in general, where you felt that the Indian real estate has become truly institutional, or now the momentum is institutional and it's not going to go back?
So I think it is institutional. It's not going to come back, firstly. It's not going to reverse. That it has been an evolution from a completely disorganized market. And when we look at some of the transparency indices that are published about the market, India has, over the last two decades, steadily risen up that transparency ranking. Another piece just that comes with the passage of time is some of the problems that came out from, let's say, around about 2005 to 2008. Some of those problems were that overseas capital was naive and domestically people were inexperienced on how to deal with capital. Whether you call that transparency, whether you call that governance, process, compliance, there was a gap there. Willing investors put money into projects that 10 years later, for sure, they would have more diligence, they'd have more knowledge. And one of the factors about the change that's come in institutionalization is that now everybody knows everybody. Everybody's got a track record. In mid-2000s, that wasn't the case. It was kind of first cycle round, and so people who could package up a good story and maybe find an investor who was looking for a good story, you know, it's a two-way street, they might get together. And a number of the overseas institutional capital players got burnt in that cycle, not just in India, but that was the case in India. So I don't think there's been one particular time, but the institutionalization has gone on probably from 2010 onwards, so that's what, 15 odd years, and a key part of that has been the emergence of private equity that's invested in first into the office sector, but now other segments, and the ability to, in a controlled manner, exit from that through public listings. And so the REIT that I was privileged to be able to work with, Embassy REIT, Jitu Vilwani's REIT with Blackstone, we listed that in 2019, but we were working on that portfolio from 14-15, so that's a 5-year cycle. I think there's probably another half a dozen such listings that have either come or are about to come. So in that period, 15 to today, I think we've got significant institutional change. The other really big change, even since 2016-17, is most of the capital today, you're probably more familiar than I am, but most of the capital on these types of listings is coming domestically.
Domestically, yes.
Whereas even when we were going on the road for Embassy REIT, the first doors that we were knocking on were overseas.
Yeah.
You know, now it's not the case, which is fantastic. It shows that there's a really great growing capital base in India, and again, people are proven in that market, and people know what you're dealing with, and you can apply an appropriate risk premium. So I think that institutionalization is a continuum over the last decade.
Yeah, so it's interesting you talk about your experience as the first sort of public REIT, and that was another first in your feather in your cap, so as to say. What really, I think, what changed back then was as the firms started to getting listed as REITs. I think the entire governance structure, entire capital deployment process, the understanding of risk, the understanding of markets, deepened. You know, the listing helped deepen that very significantly, yeah. Right? The markets had matured both on the sort of development side as well as the professional side. But still, just going through that as the sort of first pioneer in REIT market as a CEO, how was that sort of experience like? It was a lot of learning as you went.
Enormous learning, yeah. Enormous. That it was also my first time of being involved in an IPO and listing a company. And so, again, the beauty of the opportunities that, particularly in Asia, are available to one. And I had, some of the best coaches and mentors that are there in the world around that, through our sponsor, Blackstone. So lots of learning, sometimes wondering how to prioritize the hundreds of messages, the emails that are coming through, the documentation, and so on and so forth. So everyone, including the CEO, needs to be learning and where possible, finding a mentor who can help them through that process. And I've done that over the last 3, 4, 5 years on some subsequent listings. I've worked with the management teams of upcoming entities who are going through the IPO or REIT process. And that has been, I think it's been rewarding for them, and it's been rewarding for me to pass on my learning. And sometimes I say to people that I work with, if I was doing the same thing that I was doing 10 years ago today, then I should be fired.
Yep.
We've all got to be constantly figuring out what's the next thing, what do I have to learn? How can I learn from even the most junior person in the office? Because let's say if we're talking AI today, the person who's going to really be on top of it is a young techie, yeah, guy in the office. And I'll sit down with him and say, show me what you're doing, tell me how you do that. And so having that acknowledgement about needing to learn, whether it be about an IPO or about how do I use Claude and ChatGPT. So the partners of our business need to learn.
Yep.
So all these processes are the first. There's a first for everyone in everything, and I think we should all be perfectly happy to acknowledge that we don't know everything and we need to learn more.
So it's a perfect, your answer is perfect segue into my next question, which kind of moving away a bit towards AI. There's a lot of talk around AI and what it's likely to do to careers, what's it likely to do to the office space. What's your view on that? As you kind of look at the world, you put your 30 years, 35 years of experience, and as you're kind of looking at the world, which is developing very fast.
Yeah, it's a question that I'm not sure any of us can be definitive about one way or other and how that's working. you know, I think about it as I'm sure you do. You've got two daughters who are coming into the workforce. I've got four boys who are in a similar place. And we talk about it and what it means for their careers and their lives and how, same thing, that how they should be learning and thinking about what it impacts. I certainly I've been saying for many years to one of my boys, you know, if you don't fancy a white collar job, become an electrician, because that space in the world is just going to keep expanding and electrification and so on. You know, study electronics engineering, electrical engineering, follow that path, focus on energy. All you can do is what's within your sphere. And I think what we can't do is just assume it's going to be the same for the next 10 years as it's been the last 10. I think office has gone through a huge tumult over, particularly since just before COVID. I think we've seen interesting changes in the way in which office has become more like hotel.
Yeah.
So you don't have that long-term annuity income that the old school was built on, the 15, 20, 25 year lease. So that's, I'm a big believer in office as a place of collaboration and engagement. Even in our small business, we've got 60, 70 people here in Singapore. You know, we like to have our people in the office engaging with each other. It's easier and faster to make decisions. I know, you know, you've got the biggest bank in the world. They feel the same. There's definitely something that one loses by having a remote workforce. It's harder to do. I spoke earlier on about building teams and energy around your business. It's much harder to do that at a remote level. But one thing I must say, you know, your office that we're sitting in now is absolutely fantastic. I love the way that you've got these collaboration spaces. You've got the best view in town. You know, you've got the ability to have heads down working and collaboration, teamwork. So who knows? But for sure, the old school grade B plus office is and probably will continue to struggle. So then how do you repurpose?
Coming back to sort of AI, and of course there's this whole discussion about job losses and therefore its impact on office sector. I think our contention is very clear on that, you know, much like, you know, iPhones, when they came, they created a lot more jobs because people were developing apps and this kind of whole new industry emerged. We think AI is likely to kind of shape how you sort of, you know, do work for sure. Mm. Definitely a lot more efficient, but it's likely to create a lot more jobs. So I think that's how kind of we are kind of seeing right now. Is that something which resonates with you?
I hope so.
Yeah, it's hard to call.
I hope so.
Definitely.
So I certainly hope so. All we can do as individuals is keep stretching ourselves and keep learning and look at the next piece of the jigsaw, which, you know, in some ways is how we've morphed our assets AGP business from a pure real estate play into an energy and digital infrastructure play. Yeah. Because if there's one component that looks pretty certain to take advantage of this trend, it's providing the infrastructure for AI through data center.
Yeah, and the trick I suppose, careers, and even when looking at perhaps an advice to Gen Zs and beyond, is really to continue to learn and continue to pivot, yeah. Right? And it depends on where the business is going. So, for example, you just said at AGP, which was anchored in real assets, but has moved into digital infrastructure and sustainable energy.
Yeah.
And those are great places to be in, yeah. From a career perspective.
Yeah.
Coming to a few sort of, you know, personal questions here. You came to India with one boy, Finn, I remember his name. Right. He's kind of running around. He's a toddler back then. And of course, your wife, Gabby. And then you had three more sons in India. They were all, bunch of them studied in India for a period of time. Speak Hindi, Kannada.
Actually, more Tamil than
more Tamil, right?
There you go.
How do you think that experience sort of shaped them, and how are they coping being back in the UK? I think all four are in boarding houses, and one's working. Of course.
Three are now working. Three of them went to a boarding school in Ooty.
Right.
And I think, as you said, you mentioned Gabby, my fantastic wife, who's been the one who's kind of supported me through this haphazard journey. We decided that, given the fact that we felt we were settled in India for a reasonable period of time, that we would send the boys to a hill station school down in Ooty. And Finn went there for 7 years until he was 18. The other boys went there for 5 years until they were 16. And it has been, you know, magnificent. I think in our life, that would be one of our happiest, when we look back at decisions, that was a great decision. Those boys came out with a really grounded view of life. They not entitled in any way. It was all round fantastic. And the move back to Europe for them, actually it makes it easier for them, because you know, the resilience that a lot of people get from being in a challenging environment, if you take that on board and learn from it, that can serve you very, very well. So we're so pleased about that, and they're so proud. Whenever they get opportunity to have holidays, they're often popping back to India. In fact, you'll laugh at this one. Two of them went to see a South Indian friend of theirs in South London a few weeks ago, and they ended up playing for a Sunday league football team, but the team was a Tamil football team. So these are the only two non-Tamil.
Well, at least they could speak to each other, well, right?
So you know, again, India's given them all so much, and it's been a great education for a world that is, even though in some ways now it feels like it's fragmenting somewhat. But you know, we are in a global world, and there's just so much to learn from all the other people in the world. And when they're looking at India, you're talking about the most populous country. There's a lot to learn from India, and that's been a good experience.
And you've been, you know, very few expats that I know. I think I probably don't know anyone else who's had such a long association with India, right? Mm. You've sort of left India thrice in that 30-year period. You've went back. Even now you're based in Singapore, but you're kind of, you know, you're primarily anchored around India from your business perspective. What keeps you going? Is there something you can put your finger on? I mean, of course, there's a lot of excitement there, but you know, you just keep going back.
So one of chartered accountant in our office here in Singapore, he said to me a couple of days ago after a trip to India, he said, it's just so exciting. You feel the buzz when you go to India. And that's interesting. He's an Indian guy who lives over here in Singapore. And that's absolutely true. You go there, and there is always something new. People want to try something that's new. Sometimes, again, the experience, you might dial down the things that you want to try because you need to focus. But there's an energy about the place. There's an openness to innovation and new things. And that's what we want, right? It's not what's the economy, what's the GDP. It's about the people that I've come to know over the years, both in work and at a personal level, and the energy and positivity that they bring to our work day and our life day. So that's the number one thing for me.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you for that. I think it's a great answer. If you were advising a global investor looking at India today, what would be your top advice? New investor wanting to get into India.
I think you've got to listen to as many experienced people as possible. Don't come with preconceptions that are built on your geography or your country. I think that happens less and less nowadays. I think people, because of information flow as well, people are much better educated about things. But so I would talk to as many trusted advisor people that you can find. And I think that would be the specific for me. I would say, go and talk to, here's half a dozen people that you spend an hour or two with them and take their perspective. And you'll hear themes come out of each one. And then you apply that to your business and what you want to do. I don't think there's a one size fits all or a magic answer to that. It's somewhere that takes a long time to get to know and understand, and therefore lean on people who have been and are. I mean, I can think of a number of very, very senior people, particularly in the property development and investment world, who gave me a lot of time and advice 20 years ago. Go and talk to those people and understand the nuances of the market. People are very constructive.
Last couple of questions. So what belief did you hold strongly when you first came to India? And is that still valid or has that changed?
I do have a fundamental belief that people want to do the right thing. And if you lay out a canvas and the right incentives with people, and that doesn't only mean financially, it means also personal motivations and so on, that people will endeavor to deliver to you. If there isn't alignment, I think it's important to be in a respectful way, to be clear. You know, we don't see eye to eye on some, you know, some people don't see eye to eye with me on what used to be called work-life balance. You know, I'm a believer that I'm a kind of all-in person. And now, if people don't want to be all-in, that's totally fine. But it's not going to be, you know, on the same team as me. It's not. It's going to be difficult. And so we've all got choices in life. So if people don't want to be on a team that plays in a particular way, that's okay. You know, find another team. So my belief is you know, I maybe naively believe that what energizes me energizes other people. That's not always the case, and that's okay, because you don't all have to play on the same team.
Yeah, sure. And Mike, I know you are a workaholic. You, you know, works, you know, that's what, and you just explained that.
But you see, I don't see it as work. I see, I was talking.
You see that as fun and play,
I was
right?
talking to a good friend of ours the other day, and you know, he said, "Are you enjoying Singapore?" And I said, "Well, it's what we do." Yeah. I was talking to him. It's what you and I do. You know, we that's what we do, not for a living. It is our life.
So you might find this question hard to answer then, which is, what do you do outside work? Is there a Mike Holland outside work?
Yeah, so I, in the last few years, I've become very focused on trying to stay fit, because the egg timer is moving away for all of us. I think we're all becoming more conscious that we can't keep up the pace that our types of careers demand, unless you're in good physical and mental shape. I heard a great phrase the other day, you know, healthy mind, healthy body, sharp mind, right attitude. You know, you got it. So I, in time outside work, I do, you know, I'm pretty focused on staying fit. And then I have some downtime with my family in Italy. I have a very nice farmhouse in Italy that, you know, we do have downtime. It's also quite handy from a time zone perspective that I can sneak out of bed at 5 a.m. and do a few hours of calls.
Oh, the old Wi-Fi and calls.
and
to get that disconnected.
Yeah. So, and, you know, whatever it is, it's around people. You know, that's what does it for me. That's what I do outside of work, people. And a lot of those people are in our industry and they're related to what we've done. But that's okay. You know, that's common interest.
Excellent. So healthy body, sharp mind, and great attitude. I think Mike, you embody all of that for all the years I've known. It was great chatting to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your friendship.